Hey, and welcome to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. For a little over a year, the American Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, has been led by a man named Robert Califf. Very few people seem to know much about Califf or his background, and there is very little critical reporting on this man, despite the power he currently wields over significant aspects of American public health policy. During his confirmation hearings last year, there were a few stories here and there, noting Califf's investments in the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industries, as well as his longstanding ties to Big Pharma and how this might present a conflict of interest. Yet there is a deeper problem with Califf that goes far beyond these conflicts of interest that more often than not are the norm within the U.S. federal government and on Capitol Hill. This is Califf's second stint as FDA commissioner, having previously held the post toward the end of Barack Obama's second term. After he left that position when Donald Trump took office in early 2017, Califf joined Google, becoming the Silicon Valley giant's top strategist for its forays into healthcare, specifically for Google's health-focused subsidiary, Verily Life Sciences. Ever since then, Califf has been at the vanguard of the effort to kickstart the so-called Fourth Industrial Revolution, or 4IR, in healthcare, and this has extended into the decisions he has overseen over the past year as head of the FDA. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Califf himself is a major evangelist for the 4IR in healthcare and is on record stating that he shared the 4IR vision of World Economic Forum Chairman Klaus Schwab well before his notoriety during the COVID era. Per Schwab and his allies, the 4IR, particularly as it relates to healthcare, is about the merging of our physical, digital, and biological selves, essentially transhumanism by a different name. Troublingly, as FDA commissioner, Califf is already creating regulatory loopholes for devices that will bring this dark vision to fruition, including brain-machine interfaces, neuromodulation devices, and surveillance wearables, among others. He is also doing the same with other 4IR health-focused technologies, including gene therapies and much more. For those Americans who are concerned about the push to inject the 4IR into the American healthcare system and into our bodies, Robert Califf is the man to watch. Joining me today to discuss Califf and the deeper problems here is Maddie Bannon, investigator, researcher, and contributor to the Last American Vagabond Substack. Last year, Maddie published a deep dive on Califf called Brave New Real World Data on the TLAB Substack, which focused on Califf's time before he became FDA commissioner and his love affair with the World Economic Forum and the idea of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. I highly recommend anyone interested in Califf and the broader issues at play here give Maddie's piece a read. With that being said, welcome to Unlimited Hangout, Maddie. It's great to have you here.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, as I mentioned just a minute ago, it's been acknowledged, right, that Robert Califf has a concerning conflict of interest with Big Pharma, which is, as you note in your article, you know, Bernie Sanders, among others, have challenged him on this. So I guess before we get into some of the other key aspects about Califf here, particularly about the 4IR and things like that, let's talk a little bit about his connections to Big Pharma.
Sure. Well, first of all, his Gusto trial, which was a mega trial, over 40,000 participants in the study of cardiomyoinfarction, which is a heart attack, was funded a lot by Bayer, Sanofi, GlaxoSmithKline, all the big names. So he's been receiving funding from the big pharmaceutical industries for the majority of his career. Most of his papers that he's issued, and a lot of people, when they're interviewing him, are sure to make note of that he's one of the most cited medical writers in the field. They're sure to make note of that of his many papers, it's like over 1,200 that he's published. They're all punctuated by very long conflict of interest statements that list, you know, dozens and dozens of pharmaceutical companies. So he has a very cozy relationship with all of them.
Right. But I guess one of the things I want to talk about today is that, and what I've talked about in some of my work over the past couple years, is that Big Pharma and Big Tech have essentially been coming together, creating a lot of joint ventures. And so what has been sort of emerging over the same time frame is, you know, whereas there was previously this well-known revolving door between, you know, the FDA and Big Pharma and other, you know, healthcare focused agencies like HHS and Big Pharma, now there's a revolving door between those health agencies and big tech firms like Google. So Califf is one of these guys, of course, but there's actually quite a few. So if you go to the Google Health About Us page. Now that Caliph is, you know, more or less not officially a big part of it, but as you note in your piece, he still is very much connected to Google Health and its initiatives there. But their new chief health officer is a lady named Karen DeSalvo. She was formerly the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology and Assistant Secretary for Health in the Obama administration, and prior to that worked in HHS. And then we have Dr. Michael Howell, who is at Google Health Chief Clinical Officer and Deputy Chief Health Officer. He's an advisor to the Centers for Disease Control. And then one of the newest hires at Google Health is a man named Bakul Patel, who's Senior Director of Global Digital Health Strategy. And I guess the relationship with regulatory agencies. And he was, he'd been at the FDA for decades before joining Google, most recently as the FDA's Chief Digital Health Officer of Global Strategy and Innovation. So there's a lot of these guys, but of course, probably the most important one to point out would be Caliph. As I mentioned in my intro, Caliph was, of course, at the FDA during the Obama administration, and then he joined Google. So I guess maybe you could tell us a little bit about his time at Google and why that's significant.
Sure. So Caliph served as the commissioner for the FDA between the years of 2016 and 2017. That was his first stint under the Obama administration. During that time, the 21st Century Cures Act was passed, which is a very important piece of legislation that kind of allows for all of the, you know, very new breakthrough devices and EUAs and the waiver of informed consent for minimal risk trials. So that was passed during his time there. But he did leave in 2017. That's when he went back to Duke for a couple of years, and he founded Duke Forge. But in 2019, he joined Verily Life Sciences as their head of health strategy and policy. During that time, he headed Project Baseline, which that is basically, you know, a huge mega trial along the lines of the things that he's already very interested in his projects at Duke, including the Duke Clinical Research Initiative and the clinical, CTTI, which is Clinical Trials Transformation Initiative, where they're aiming to use digital infrastructure, passively collected patient data, including electronic health records. Project Baseline at Verily was kind of a replication of that at a major private company who he said has the funding to do it right, which is what he is on record noting is very important. He wants as much money as he can get to get these studies to be what he actually wants. So Verily, you know, they recruit people to join these studies. They had a wearable, a proprietary watch that is by prescription only, that sends, you know, biometric data back to Google for to be studied. They studied a number of things, including, you know, oral health and how that relates to overall health, and you know, the impacts of daylight savings time on your restiveness and overall well-being. They studied a number of very trite things, you know, that I don't think really, not a lot of these study results, while they are posted on clinicaltrials.gov, the results are not posted there, so I'm not sure what the results were, but they also study things like depression. That's basically their whole thing, is to continuously monitor and collect data because on the people that are involved in their studies, because their goal is to map human health. They said, we already have mapped the Earth, and now it is time to map human health, and that's kind of what they're after.
Yikes. Yeah. So they've mapped human health and they contract with like intelligence agencies in the military so they can, you know, like drone bomb or find whoever they want. Right. And so now we got to map the human body too. Well, that's fun. Okay. So One thing I really found interesting as a major theme in your article is this about clinical trials, specifically about Califf. So as you noted, you know, he made a name for himself with this, I guess, Gusto trial in the mid-90s. But since then, he's essentially been trying to revolutionize clinical trials and how they're performed. And so a lot of the stuff you touched on, including Project Baseline, I'd like to get in into a little more detail of those specific initiatives like that and other ones you mentioned a little bit later in this episode. But for now, I wanted to bring up that you noted in your piece that a lot of Califf's career, specifically his time at Google and this current stint as FDA commissioner, he's been spending it, quote, tirelessly dedicated to the task of removing the obstacles facing the 4IR. So I think, you know, since the 4IR is a really key part of understanding who Califf is, why he was nominated by the Biden administration to be in this particular role at this point of time, it's all very important to understanding those issues, right? So if it's cool with you, let's go over, you know, for people who may not know what the fourth industrial revolution is, what are Califf's stated views about the phenomenon, and what are some of his roles in at the FDA and Google that he's played in promoting these policies?
Sure. One of his greatest achievements, according to him, is convincing then President Obama that the fourth industrial revolution was real and happening and very important.
Oh.
So he's very much a fan, and he thinks that it is important. He thinks that it will be happening. And basically what the whole concept is that our bodies and then eventually our minds will eventually merge with technology. And the internet by proxy. So this is the concept is the brainchild of Klaus Schwab, who runs the World Economic Forum. So, you know, the whole idea of the fourth industrial revolution is to gather as much data passively generated by either people or the environment via wearable devices, electronic health records, insurance claims, you know, the devices in your car, your social media, to get it, to make you your digital self. They'd like to both merge your physical self with your digital self into one thing. So it's totally inseparable. But he, you know, he cites Klaus Schwab and the Fourth Industrial Revolution book that he wrote. In his papers, academic papers, he talks about it frequently in interviews and things like that. Yeah, that's really his contribution. He's stated that he's gone to the World Economic Forum, and I'm sure he, mm-hmm. You know, mingles among the other acolytes there. But
yeah, he's openly said that he, you know, attended the WEF and was like, wow, these guys are really on to something. In a video I saw of him where he's doing some Google interview series, I mean, he talks very glowingly about all of the stuff in the WEF itself. And of course, as you note in the piece, some of the stuff he's overseen is, you know, follows the WEF's favorite model, the public-private partnership. So he seems very much on board with a lot of this stuff. And what's particularly concerning to me is that a lot of these 4IR technologies, so like, you know, the way it's described, it's something that's not just going to revolutionize healthcare, right? It's supposed to revolutionize every sector of society, society itself, change the meaning of what it is to be human, and all other sorts of stuff. But the way they seem to be going to get sort of this, their foot in the door here, is through healthcare. And, you know, as I wrote for TLab a few years ago, that particular policy has its ties with Google going way back to the, you know, well before COVID with the Eric Schmidt-led National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence. Of course, Eric Schmidt being the longtime head of Google. And that particular commission said that the best way to get AI mass adopted by the American populace was to have it sort of shoehorned into healthcare policy. And they essentially framed this as a national security imperative. And so on this commission, you know, you have big tech and you have the national security state, you know, mainly the military and intelligence communities. And this is their view, you know, the most powerful actors really in the United States today, that it's a national security imperative to have basically the 4IR types of technologies implemented into our healthcare system first as a way of having them spread throughout society. And they frame this as you know, necessary to counter China's AI supremacy and hegemony that will, you know, allegedly happen if we don't surpass China in terms of the mass adoption of these types of technologies. But oddly enough, you know, if you really want to believe it, take national security agencies at their word, you know, that this is about China, not about like longstanding agendas of theirs to mass surveil, you know, of mass surveillance and things like that. You know, obviously that's up to you, and everyone can can have their own opinion about that. But it seems like Robert Califf's role here, and more, you know, even bigger than Califf, really is the role of Google in all of this. It's definitely something I think more people should be paying attention to at the very least. So one interesting thing that you bring up in this article is about Robert Califf, and you already mentioned it a little bit, that he was the founding director of the Duke Clinical Research Institute, which predates his time working at the FDA, but it sort of saw him partner up with the FDA while he was at Duke, where I believe he's been for a decent amount of his academic career. And this is sort of a precursor to a lot of the stuff that he's overseen since he got involved with the FDA and overtly with Google as well. So can you tell us a little, you know, maybe a little more detail about this clinical research institute he helped create and the initiative that you mentioned earlier, the Clinical Trials Transformation Initiative?
Yeah, sure. I mean, they both run along the same lines. And the gold standard for clinical trials is the randomized controlled trial. So they're looking for alternative means, because to do a randomized controlled trial, it costs a lot of money. You have to hire staff, you have to recruit participants, you have to, you know, apply the intervention or the placebo and make sure that you're tracking all the information that's associated with that. You have to have people enter that data and then make sure it's correct, and have like an actual trial site and have people go to and from and compensate them for that. So it takes a long time and it costs a lot of money. So the aim, as far as I can tell, and from writings that he and others have written about, you know, real world evidence generation and real world data in place of randomized controlled trials, is that it cuts down on costs significantly, maybe up to 30%. And you can definitely get it done a little bit faster. So if you already have a pool of people whose information that you already have access to, for instance, like I mentioned, the you know, cell phone data, electronic health records, insurance claims, all that, you don't need to bother recruiting the participants. You don't need to wait for that information to come in, especially for the low risk trials that, you don't need informed consent for those anymore, thanks to the 21st Century Cures Act that was passed in 2016. So you can get a lot of things done faster and more cheaply if you use information that's, like he says, siloed and not interoperable. And what Duke Clinical Research Institute and the CTTI are aiming to do is advocate for those data to be unsiloed so that they're free, they're shareable, and also to advocate for trials that use that kind of data instead of the randomized controlled trial of the past and that traditional sort of trials.
So let's talk a little bit about what this means for, you know, the average person that doesn't necessarily, like, you know, research these kind of worlds very much. So like the way that medical and clinical trials have been conducted pretty much in the vast majority of the modern era, right? This initiative was about essentially replacing those trials with this real world evidence paradigm. Right. And you have a really helpful graphic about what real world data and real world evidence is in this piece. And you know, that you wrote and some other, you know, descriptions of it that you provide in the piece. But the graphic's interesting because it reminds me a lot of the World Economic Forum's policy paper, I think from 2018, about digital ID, where essentially all these different things are interconnected and there's really like this centralized database for data about you. And so what's really crazy about it to me is that, you know, it has like, you know, you're in the center, right? And all these different types of data that you generate are coming off, you know, from you, and that this data is going to be used to replace a clinical trial to prove the effectiveness of drugs or wearables or, you know, brain machine interfaces, you know, all this type of stuff. And it has stuff like, you know, disease registries, things you'd expect, right? Like electronic health records, survey data, pharmaceutical data, like what types of medicines you take, and then the wearable stuff. But it also has stuff like consumer data, which is your buying habits, what you buy online, right? But also social media data, you know, what you're interacting with, what you're seeing online, what type of information you're reading and viewing, which is interesting in the context of something I'd like to talk about a bit later, which is Robert Califf's mission to have the FDA play a major role in preempting and debunking misinformation, which is interesting there. But the idea that all of this data, this monitoring of stuff that has never really been used in existing randomized clinical trials and stuff like social media data, and just sort of data harvesting this stuff from people without their consent and using that in lieu of randomized clinical trials is just totally insane. And I just, in this, you know, the people that wanted to put him in charge of the FDA obviously knew that he was in charge of these types of initiatives, and that he was, you know, essentially there to create the regulatory, I guess, you know, I'm calling it a regulatory loophole, but really it's a complete alteration of the existing regulatory paradigm to totally just replace it so that all of this fourth industrial revolution technology can be fast-tracked in mass, you know, for mass implementation, mass adoption by the masses. But it doesn't necessarily have to use the previous paradigm to prove any safety, any effectiveness under past metrics, right? I don't know your thoughts on that. Maybe you disagree.
I mean, the problem is that you can't really verify whether or not the information that you're receiving is good or bad. They're trying to come up with ways to do that, but I don't think that that's really feasible. So, you know, the one way that Califf has, you know, he gave a talk at Google. It was like a Google Talks event. It's on YouTube. He mentions that the one way, well, at least one of the ways that we'll find out if these things go wrong is if they become catastrophic. So that's when we'll know how to regulate these kinds of trials, is if there's like a massive safety or efficacy catastrophic situation that occurs. As he says, that's how things have gone in the past. But, you know, when you're talking about mega trials with, you know, over 40,000 people, like he's already done, that's, I don't know if the benefit risk calculus really makes sense there. So, to be honest, I don't think that these real world evidence based trials are going to supersede randomized control trials entirely. I think that they are using them to fast track certain sort of medications and devices, at least through phase one and phase two trials. And they're applying it to post market studies as well. So as far as actually when medical devices or drugs have some sort of risk to them, I think they're still applying the randomized controlled trial. But they're implementing and using this as much as possible to cut down on costs and getting those things to market as quickly as possible. And another thing too that I've been thinking about is that he uses a lot of language of these being important and necessary so that those drugs and devices can be made available to the public as, you know, more quickly. And that's kind of the pill that he gives you to swallow alongside the near constant surveillance that he alleges will be occurring, and that is occurring, because people need these life-saving, you know, devices now. They don't need them in 5 to 7 years, but
right.
Really you're asking the consumer to adopt all the risk there.
Well, we heard this with COVID, right? The same thing, like mm-hmm. a change of the regulatory paradigm for the purpose of, oh, we need to get this out faster. So we have to produce a vaccine on a timeline that's completely unprecedented, and we have to change how trials are conducted. And, you know, as I've noted in my work and other people have noted, you know, a lot of these companies like Moderna, for example, couldn't get a product to market under the previous regulatory paradigm. And so the emergency use authorization and a lot of these, you know, emergency measures were used to sort of totally change how a lot of these trials for these vaccines were conducted. And, you know, because of the, you know, professed sense of urgency, that, you know, this idea that, you know, the risk is being taken on by the person that receives, you know, the vaccine, instead of having, you know, the FDA saying, yeah, we can say it. Well, I mean, they did say it was safe, right? But, you know, that wasn't necessarily reflected by the trials, and it was all justified by speed. And, you know, what you're seeing here is them using speed as the justification and also cost reduction. But, you know, it's troubling stuff. And I may have misspoken earlier. What I meant is that, so in your piece, you were talking about CTTI, this transformation, clinical trial transformation initiative, and you said it seeks to do is to use real world evidence in place of evidence generated by RCTs. And so I sort of see what Robert Califf is doing now at the FDA sort of as not necessarily trying to replace, you know, eliminate randomized clinical trials entirely. But when it comes to a lot of these more like novel devices, not necessarily things like vaccines and like pharmaceutical products that are more traditional, like pills and other types of injections and stuff, it seems to be some of these other devices, whether they're wearables or implantables, really also are sort of being treated under this this new paradigm, this idea of like the remote clinical trial. It's not necessary to physically monitor and observe patients and just basically use the data that's collected by their interaction with these devices and the connectivity, and all of that is essentially replacing traditional trials. And to me, that seems sort of like a way of sidestepping some of the traditional metrics for these particular devices, which, of course, those devices are obviously necessary to get the 4IR really rolling in the healthcare space, right? Particularly with the, you know, the brain machine interface or some of these neuromodulation devices sort of get the nervous system of the human body connected to the internet, right?
yeah, what's funny about that is the breakthrough devices designation given by the FDA to medical devices is really for devices that are to treat life-threatening or irreversible diseases, which when you think of a brain-computer interface, sure, you can maybe make the claim that our brain-computer interface can treat paralysis or help the blind see, or the, you know, stroke victims have more functioning sides of their body. Yeah, that's fine, but they also will be applied for many, many other uses. So it just seems to me that companies like BlackRock and Technologies and Synchron and Neuralink, et cetera, are using this, you know, this claim that their brain computer interface will be used to treat life threatening and irreversible diseases as a way to get their stuff through the door and prioritize that at FDA so that it can be pushed through more quickly, you know, disregarding all the other applications that it may be used for, and it will most likely be used for, and that's probably what their primary aim is at the end of the day.
So even though you mentioned that like the breakthrough device designation technically is sort of like reserved for these devices that are like for, you know, irreversible, you know, diseases, terminal illnesses and conditions, stuff like that, it's being given to a lot of things that don't follow under these metrics. So a recent FDA breakthrough device designation was given to this company called Suma, which is very much, you know, it's basically Soma, but with a second O. And it received that designation for its innovative at-home depression treatment device, which it describes basically, well, in the picture in the article anyway, it's basically like electrodes you wear on like a weird little beanie thing over your head. And it like, electroshocks you, I guess, certain parts of the brain to like make you not depressed, right? But there's a lot of other treatments for depression, right? And breakthrough device designation is supposed to be for conditions that don't have existing treatments, you know? So this is one of those examples of sort of the FDA sort of applying this designation to places where it doesn't really need to be given, right? And so, you know, if you look at this example and a few others, it seems pretty clear that the current FDA modus operandi as it comes to this, as it relates to this particular designation. It seems to just sort of be giving it to companies that, you know, have some of these 4IR related devices or, you know, neuromodulation stuff specifically, and trying to get them onto the market as quickly as possible, allegedly for the benefit of consumers. But, you know, when you get these sort of special designations, you're allowed to sort of skip a lot of the, you know, the regulations and trials and other requirements that, you know, competitors would have to complete, you know, competitors that don't receive this particular designation.
Yeah, right. I mean, what the breakthrough device designation also allows for novel medical devices. They call it de novo. So there's no, you know, to be a de novo device, there's not any legally marketed predicate device. So something like it. As far as I know, Summa has at least some competitors. I saw other sort of beanie electrode applications and devices a lot like it. So maybe they're competing for that space. My initial thought when I saw their device, the head cap and the electrodes, is I thought we had already kind of tried electroshock therapy for, you know, mental illness, and that it didn't really work too well and also made people a little bit weird and it was not good. So I think I understand that it's a little bit more low voltage, but it doesn't seem to be too original of an idea. As far as, let's see, they use a technique called transcranial direct current stimulation. And really, neuromodulation is, well, there are a few different definitions that I was able to find, but they're mostly that the International Neuromodulation Society defines it as the alteration of nerve activity through targeted direct delivery of a stimulus through electric or chemical agents in at certain sites. So we have a lot of companies that are looking at the spleen, which is what is that nerve called? There's a certain nerve that originates at the spleen, and it's part of the autonomic nerve system. And they're looking at that for Parkinson's to stop the hand tremors.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of people looking at that for that, and they also are trying to use it for rheumatoid arthritis and things like that.
Yeah, so one of the companies pursuing neuromodulation of that particular nerve you mentioned, I guess the splenic nerve, is for rheumatoid arthritis, is Galvani Bioelectronics, which is an interesting company in the context of Robert Califf, because it's a joint venture of GlaxoSmithKline and Verily, which is Google's health subsidiary that Robert Califf has been involved with over the years. And they're one of the ones that sort of got this... I think they've already started implanting it into people, but they have a lot of ambitions for these neuromodulation devices, which is basically to alter how the nervous system functions, whether it's targeting specific nerves or many nerves or groups of nerves or the entire brain. That's sort of the whole ambition there. And of course, Verily is also the people behind Project Baseline, which is something that you mentioned earlier. And I think not enough people have paid attention to this. And it's a really crazy thing when you think about it. So there's this one, there's a few things that have been written on Baseline, you know, from mainstream sources. One summary offered here, in which you sort of have touched on already and what you've talked about, it says, the Verily Baseline Health Study launched in 2017, so that's around the same time that Califf was at Google and being their top health strategist, right? It was launched in 2017 with the goal of mapping human health by collecting data from a variety of sources, including self-reported data, smartphone or wearable recorded data, or through electronic health records. And as you mentioned earlier, because of the Cures Act, some of that recorded data by smartphone or wearables, that data can be obtained without informed consent. Anyway, so it says essentially a lot of this baseline health study and the broader baseline health platform is all about changing, again, how clinical trials function. Right. So I first heard about Project Baseline during the COVID stuff because they were using it specifically for that. And a bunch of weird stuff was going on with Verily and COVID tests, including having people forcing people who took COVID-19 tests in the San Francisco area, which were being managed. I think the government there had contracted Google or Verily to do this, and they were requiring people that got COVID tests to basically link their test results to their Google account. And if they didn't have a Google account, they had to make one in order to participate, which is pretty insane. But essentially, what it sounds like to me is that Project Baseline is just trying to gather an insane amount of data on people for all different types of purposes. And essentially, the goal, they say, is to collect comprehensive health information with the goal of better understanding health in the transition to disease. And it's important to keep in mind that at the same time this has been going on, and when this was launched, is when the Pentagon and Google teamed up for this sort of predictive healthcare thing. So basically, using all of this data, all of these, this massive cachet that the military holds from like the veteran and military health systems, of x-ray images and things like that, to train AI so that the AI could offer predictive cancer diagnoses. So basically, the AI is like, oh, well, we've decided that you'll develop cancer in 5 years, but you don't actually have cancer, you know? So it's all of this sort of, you know, what I've, what me and people like Ryan Christian have sort of referred to as the pre-crime paradigm applied to healthcare. So basically, you're going to be told that you're going to develop this disease by AI or some of these different devices, or by, you know, this data accumulation, and they're going to decide, they're going to tell you what you're likely to develop before you develop it, and then go and offer you all these different weird therapeutics, whether it's stuff like, you know, mRNA stuff or gene therapy or, you know, these neuromodulation devices or wearables or stuff that interacts, you know, with your nervous system or changes how it functions and all sorts of stuff. Even though at that particular moment, you don't actually need it, it's being framed as preventative, right? And this is, again, Google with the military doing this, and you have them, of course, doing it in all their sorts of different guises. But ultimately, you know, it's about, per them, about healthcare, right? But it seems to be a lot more than that, if you ask me. But, you know.
Yeah, and Caliph, in an interview, he mentions that this sort of, you know, influence, subtle influence over people in regards to their health is, you know, justifiable, because it's already happening, and it's been happening for a while through, you know, private market advertisements and cookies on your computer and tracking what you buy and figuring out what you might be interested in buying and then presenting that to you. So he's just, and he thinks that doing that isn't necessarily good. It's not getting people things that they need or make them have a happier, healthier life. So what he's saying is, well, that's bad. When we do it, it's good, because we're trying to help people live longer and be less ill. So we're going to track you in just the same way. We're going to nudge you and influence you in just the same way. But our ends are delivering those drugs and those medical devices that you need, right? You'll be convinced that you need them because we have all the data, and we'll present to you evidence that we found and tell you how this will help you in your life before you're even considering, you know, going to the doctor about it. So like you said, it is preemptive, and he thinks that it's totally fine. There's good guys and bad guys, and the bad guys are the people who sell you clothes and food and stuff like that. But they're good because they sell you pharmaceutical drugs and medical devices.
Yeah, crazy. So, so in your particular article, in talking about the Cures Act, you sort of mentioned that Caliph had a role in getting that certain aspects of that legislation, you know, in place, you know, involved in to an extent in the drafting and lobbying process for this particular law. And so I found it interesting too that rolled within that act were things like the BRAIN initiative and Biden's Cancer Moonshot initiative, which you know, was basically the basis for Biden's recent creation of ARPA-H, which was previously shopped around to the Trump administration under the name of HARPA, or basically a health-focused DARPA equivalent. And I actually did a podcast a few months ago about one of the guys behind the Brain Initiative and how he has been very active where I live down in South America in Chile, and getting Chile to be the first country to establish what are called neuro rights. This idea of trying to protect your individuality, and sort of this paradigm where brain machine interfaces and all of this are very common. And essentially, you know, what I sort of talked about this likely being in that particular podcast, instead of it being framed as protecting you from all the bad stuff these devices could do to you, making you lose your sense of self, among other things, is really about creating the necessary framework and public justifications to get these types of devices on the market, not necessarily for healthcare related purposes, but also for commercial purposes. Because people like Elon Musk at like Neuralink and stuff, you know, on one hand, they're saying, and I guess Synchron too, probably, and some of these other firms doing the same thing. You know, on one hand, they're framing this as, oh, this is a health device to help people that are paralyzed walk and blind people see and all of that. But at the same time, you know, Elon Musk is like pretty open that Neuralink is intended to be like used for commercial purposes. People could use it to play video games and stuff. And, you know, even some of the animal trials they promoted were like monkeys with the Neuralink implant playing video games with their brain and stuff, not paralyzed monkeys walking again. You know what I mean? So it just seems, you know, a bit different than it's being sold.
Sure. I think, you know, for the brain computer interfaces, the only there's a difference between imagination and reality. And you can, you know, postulate and say that our BCI is going to help people walk or see or whatever. I don't see any evidence of that, at least as far as the initial studies and footage and things like that. That there's no evidence for that actually happening. As far as what is able to be accomplished is that you can control, like, so if you're a total, if you're 100% paraplegic and you have no way to move your hands or you interface with the computer, you can do so, they say, quote unquote, simply by thinking. And while that may have medical application, you know, if you're trying to help people who are paralyzed, sure, but why can't anybody else use it for that? So it's just to pass it under the guise and get these sort of fast tracks to market, seemingly to preempt your competition and kind of monopolize that market as soon as you can, which is, I would say, Synchron is definitely much further ahead than anybody else on that front. That seems to be what it's actually for, because you know, the brain computer interfaces, there's just not enough evidence out there to suggest that it's actually going to help people with their claims of, you know, the irreversibly debilitating diseases or the life-threatening diseases. There is one company, it's called, I think it's called like Neuralink or Neuraleaf. That's what it is. They have this brain computer interface that links with an exoskeleton that helps people who have had a stroke move the hand that's not working anymore. That makes more sense. But yeah, it seems more just to try to get these things on the market as quickly as possible under the guise of helping people, as is, you know.
Yeah. And what I mentioned earlier, there's this whole, you know, ulterior motive coming from the highest levels of the national security state and people like Eric Schmidt trying to get this stuff out there on the market as quickly as possible, because they see it as part of this big tech war with China, right? Which is also pretty crazy. And, you know, a key point I want to make here, too. So I'm sure people are familiar with, you know, my analysis and other people's analysis of statements made by people tied up with the World Economic Forum and big, you know, 4IR evangelists like Yuval Noah Harari, who basically say that, like, the whole wearable paradigm, like getting wearables on everybody, is the red line that will, you know, result in the ushering in of what he calls digital dictatorships. You know, basically the surveillance of what's going on, not just inside your body, but inside your mind. And I think this is all kind of interesting when you're looking at the big players here in the context of a lot of how this mass surveillance is also, you know, tied into this effort to launch a war on domestic terror and mass surveil everybody and sort of usher in the paradigm they tried to do after 9/11 with things like DARPA's total information awareness and stuff. So, you know, you have groups like Google and also Palantir, which is basically, you know, as I've noted in my work, essentially a CIA front that is basically total information awareness privatized. And so Palantir basically has access and has been running a lot of the COVID-19 health data and other health data held by HHS. And also in the United Kingdom, basically all NHS data is being managed by Palantir as well. And then you have Google having this big role. For example, they host the FDA's My Studies program and on Google Cloud, and they have for some time. And you have a lot of these, you know, this revolving door, like we talked about earlier, sort of between the regulatory agencies and Google, and Verily is being used for a lot of these new remote trials to get some of these, you know, more novel devices, I guess, and like neuromodulation devices on the market more quickly without, you know, in-person monitoring and, you know, a completely electronically conducted, fully remote clinical trials. So, and they're teamed up with the Pentagon. I mean, there's all sorts of crazy stuff going on here. And I think some of that overlap is interesting in the context of this whole, like, you know, misinformation, trying to stop people from spreading what's deemed as misinformation about health, and how that also is, you know, one of the main objectives of this supposed war on domestic terror, because Robert Califf has been very vocal since he came in to or it came into this position last year about the need for the FDA as an agency to preempt and debunk misinformation, which is kind of ironic because some of their efforts on that front have actually involved the FDA spreading the misinformation. For example, claiming that ivermectin is not like able to be used in human beings, that it's like a horse and cow medicine exclusively. And regardless of what you think about its validity as an early treatment of COVID or whatever, well before the COVID era, it was being used in people. So to frame it as, you know, a horse dewormer exclusively, like had been done on CNN, is not accurate. And the FDA obviously knows this. So it's just interesting that you'd have, you know, Google, Palantir, they're big players in the healthcare system, getting more and more tied up with the FDA. And they're a big part of this misinformation crackdown and profiling of people spreading misinformation as well. And I think people, you know, might want to see that there's that degree of overlap there, because once you're surveilling people, whether it's under the guise of healthcare or under the guise of stopping domestic terrorism, I mean, ultimately, I think the end result is the same, essentially. And I've also kind of argued in some of my work on the creation of ARPA-H under the Biden administration, which sort of goes back to this Cures Act stuff you were talking about during the Obama administration. I mean, essentially, that's also about getting the mass use of wearables for this, you know, predictive health paradigm and precision health paradigm and all of this stuff. So, you know, maybe it's being framed as, you know, a boon for public health. But ultimately, it seems to me like the 4IR is just about an insane paradigm of mass surveillance. And they're just trying to see what sort of justifications they can make for it, you know, what sticks and what people, you know, need to believe and need to feel in order to start using that type of technology on and in their bodies.
Yeah, I think that the fourth industrial revolution, you know, while Klaus Schwab and, you know, the people who are his true believers, they describe it as the merging of our personal and digital selves, right, or quantified selves. But it's really about the last frontier, which is the mind.
Right.
And also including genetics. So they're looking to somehow be able to predict. And they've been, you know, the U.S. government, at least for a long time, has been created artificial models of the world and tried to use that to predict how military conflicts would go or certain release of information would go. They created a computer-generated models of the world and people. To the finest detail possible, hoping that they could predict the future. Really, they need a comprehensive understanding of how people think. And I think that's really what it's about. The mind is really the last frontier, and genetics, for capitalism and government and surveillance and control. So that seems to be the primary target by merging people's physical and digital selves. And while, you know, they frame it as that's something that will happen eventually and inevitably, the private market and the public-private market are kind of already doing that intentionally. So they're, you know, whether or not that would have happened otherwise is another question, but they're kind of making that happen now. And as far as the surveillance stuff goes, this is why I think artificial intelligence is so important and is, you know, considered to be an arms race at the moment between the U.S., you know, and their competitors, because it's a lot of information. That's a lot of data. It's impossible to go through all of that and to find patterns with any sort of efficiency. So you need to apply an algorithm, a machine learning algorithm or an artificial intelligence to that to find what you're looking for, or to at least flag what it thinks you might be looking for. And as far as, you know, the Patriot Act and the NSA goes, their current, at least their policies were to have a black box where all this, you know, depersonalized information lives until there's reason to go and look through it. Because a person can't go and just look through the information to find what, you know, what they think is a probable cause to look further. But you can legally have an artificial intelligence do that because it's not a person. So mm-hmm. essentially what at least to me, what seems to be the probable outcome is that there will be many more false positives, many more flags, and many more issuances of probable cause to look into people even further and, you know, to the fullest extent than there was before, because there's going to be, you know, many more patterns, or essentially, you know, patterns. What is that? Who's writing those artificial intelligence programs, and what do they consider to be a pattern of, you know, domestic terrorism or anything that would warrant probable cause? So that, I mean, something that I've read recently from you is about Gabriel and the artificial intelligence surveillance software that's being applied through things like cameras and sound. So it's certainly in the realm of technology something that is possible, especially if it's all in a readable format in text or in code.
Well, thanks for that really great summary about a lot of really complex issues and how it all ties together and, you know, a lot of what, you know, we're facing. I think people need to pay a lot more attention to the healthcare space, particularly people who were opposed to stuff like the Fourth Industrial Revolution and its encroachment on our lives and our government and really society in general, because, you know, they're trying to get a huge foot in the door through healthcare. And I would argue, and I actually have argued, I think, in some interviews I've done over the past year, that Robert Califf is at the FDA right now explicitly for this purpose. Like, as you note in your piece, he's there to remove a lot of these obstacles from this 4IR paradigm for being ushered in, you know, sort of in through the healthcare system first. You know, he's the point man for that. So I think he definitely deserves a lot more scrutiny. And that's why I was so happy to find your piece about him, and very happy to have you on today to talk about him and these, you know, these broader issues on my podcast. So thanks so much for coming on, Maddie. So where can people follow your work and support you?
So you can follow it on The Last American Vagabond Substack, which is tlavagabond.substack.com. That's where most stuff is. I also post on manufacturingreality.org, which is James Jordan's blog there, where he also contributes and stuff like that. So those are really the main two sources. You can support me by supporting TLAF, and you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Space Jelly. If you just search, you'll find me eventually.
All right, super. Well, thanks so much, Maddie, for coming on. Really appreciate your time looking into these issues, and I'm looking forward to following more of your work here in the future. And thanks to everyone for listening to this podcast, and hopefully some people listening will take the time to look into some of these deeper issues as well, because they're really, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, there is a extreme lack of reporting, not just on Robert Califf, but a lot of the issues we touched on today, and I think we ignore this kind of stuff at our own peril. So. Definitely there's a lot to dig into, and, you know, we really just scratched the surface about a lot of these issues today. And of course, as always, a big shout out to Unlimited Hangout supporters who make this podcast and pretty much all of my other work possible as well. Couldn't do it without you guys. So thanks so much. And thanks, of course, to everyone who regularly listens and shares this podcast around. And appreciate you all as well. So thanks so much to everyone for listening, and catch you all in the next episode.